The Month in Review. The news often slows down in the summertime, especially in Maine, but that has not been the case this July. Earlier this month, the Maine Supreme Judicial Court heard arguments about Medicaid expansion in our state. Last week, a Superior Court judge heard arguments about Maine's clean election law, which will determine whether more than 100 candidates will receive funding they expected for this year's election. And after child protection workers complained about the state's child welfare system, the governor says he hopes to draft legislation this week to improve it. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today, it's our monthly look back at the stories that made news with three Maine editorial page editors. What mattered to you? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The month of July has hardly been a slow news month here in Maine. Today, our editorial page editors return to talk about what made the headlines this month, from clean elections to Medicaid and more. Joining me in our Portland studio, Ben Bragdon. He's with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Greg Kessich with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News. As always, we want to hear from you. What issues in the news do you want to talk about? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. I'm going to start randomly, because all of these are such big news stories, I'm not even sure we can rank them, with the clean elections. We are waiting for a decision from Supreme Court, Superior Court Justice Bill Stokes, who heard arguments about Maine's clean election funding. And this affects candidates who are running right now, isn't it, Greg? What's at stake and what is being decided?
Well, there's actually two clean elections issues, the way I understand it. One is there's the lawsuit, which is what Judge Stokes is considering, that would force the state to spend money that had already been collected for clean elections candidates in the previous cycle, not spent on campaigns, return to the state. So it's appropriated money for clean elections that is sitting there, and all it needs to do is be signed over by the governor, who is a opponent of the whole concept of clean elections. The other thing is a legislative typo. When they were putting out the budget last summer during that government shutdown, there was a single keystroke missing that made it look like funding for clean elections ended at the end of the fiscal year, which is June 30th. So as of July 1st, there's no money for clean elections candidates. So these are publicly financed candidates who have qualified for the program and collected a certain number of $5 checks to show that they had support, and were basing their plans on receiving this money during the fall campaign. As of now, they're not getting it, as you know, anything past basically the primary. And this affects, I think, about 100 legislative candidates. My sense is it's more Democrats than Republicans. The single gubernatorial candidate who is a clean elections candidate is Terry Hayes, an independent, who has really built her whole campaign around getting this money to be able to spend it. And it's become another leverage point for the governor and a group of House Republicans who don't like the program and are using every advantage they have to withhold this money and try to trade it for something else.
And so what it really means, if I'm a clean election candidate, I got a little bit of money before the primary, but now I don't think I'm going to get, or I may not be getting, the money that's been promised to me, but I can't fundraise privately,
right?
Because I'm a clean election candidate.
You're not allowed to raise any. Yeah, you're not allowed to go out and raise money.
Okay, Ben, Craig mentioned that most of the clean election candidates are Democrats. Is the governor opposing this because he philosophically is opposed to public financing of candidates, or is it because he sees this as a tactical move to get more Republicans in the state house?
Well, you can certainly see it that way. He's been opposed to this for the beginning, so that's nothing new. So his opinion on this hasn't changed based on the content of this year's race. But it's certainly changing the rules in the middle of the game. Like Greg said, these candidates were depending on this money. They can't go out and raise more. We had a candidate up in Waterville, a Republican, for a candidate for House, who asked the Elections Commission this week, just let me spend some of my own money. Now I'll keep the receipts, and then when I get the clean election money, I'll pay it back because I gotta get moving, and they won't let him because that's a violation of the Clean Elections Law, which is a law that was passed and supported by the people and funded by the people. And yet the governor and his allies in the legislature aren't carrying it out. So we can add this, I guess, to the long list of laws that the governor just has decided not to follow.
And we should point out, this is money that's already appropriated, but the Ethics Commission is unable to spend it because of the error. And same thing with the lawsuit. The money is there, but they're unable to allocate it to the candidate. So it's not like the governor is saving the public any money through his opposition to clean elections.
And Susan, not only is the money there, but we've just found out the state government has a larger than expected surplus.
Yes, technically, but when you're not spending money on public health nurses, which the governor was just sued for, I believe yesterday, not spending money on social safety net programs and on and on and on, do we actually have a surplus or is it just on paper?
Also in the courts, also, Ben, what we're waiting for a decision from Maine's Supreme Judicial Court is Medicaid expansion. We have people signing up for Medicaid at the same time that the governor has said, was it over my dead body? I will.
Or go to jail or something.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. I've got it mixed up. Yeah. That's right. I will go to jail. I'm sorry. I was confused about that. So Ben, when do we expect a decision from Maine's Supreme Judicial Court? If the Supreme Judicial Court rules in favor of these people who are signing up for Medicaid, is that it? Is that the end of the story?
No, I don't think it is. This story is probably going to keep on going. So a lower court ruled that the LePage administration had to follow the law and submit an application to start the process to expand Medicaid. They were supposed to file this, I think, back in April, and they just kind of blew past that deadline. They were sued by Maine Equal Justice Partners, and a lower court said, yes, you have to go ahead and file this application. The governor appealed. It's now in front of the Supreme Judicial Court. They heard arguments maybe a couple weeks ago now. I think a decision is expected at any moment. It's hard to say what they're going to say. I mean, if they say you have to go ahead and file this application, then the governor might do so. It's very easy to do, and that would start the process. But then, you know, he missed the April deadline. He missed another deadline in July. So doing, you know, in August what he was supposed to do in April, you know, we're getting pretty close to the end of his term here. And Greg and I were just talking about it, that, you know, we said after the election that this Maine Care expansion was going to be an issue through the last year of his term, and would be a fight the entire way. And it looks like that's going to be how it is. I don't know how the court can the court can say these things, can compel him to do some things, but it all takes a lot of time, and the time is just running out on his term. It looks like it's going to be the up to the next governor.
Yeah. And I say you know, the governor's position is that he doesn't have the money because the legislature didn't give it to him, even though they passed a bill that would have given him the money.
And he vetoed it.
And as you said, we've got a surplus, and there is enough money in the Medicaid account to cover these people. And there would be likely throughout the rest of his term. So, you know, he has the money. He's saying he refuses to spend it unless the legislature gives it to him. But if they don't give it to him just the way he wants it, he's going to veto it, and then he won't have it.
Susan, another thing the governor surprised people with is the announcement just yesterday that he's going to challenge some of the Clean Air ACT regulations that our region follows. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's a petition from the State Department of Environmental Protection to take Maine out of what's called the ozone transport region. Maine's often called the tailpipe of the U.S. because most of the pollution here is blown in from states to our west and the south. We produce some here, but most of it comes from other states. That's why we're in a multi-state agreement to all adopt the same regulations on industry so that we will clean up the pollutants that are the precursors to ozone, which is also known as smog. The administration argues that the air in Maine generally is clean and meets EPA standards, which is true. But you've all seen the email alerts on bad air days that the DEP sends out. And those particularly affect southern coastal Maine and Acadia National Park. So if you have asthma or other respiratory ailments, you're encouraged to stay indoors, or if you go outside, don't exert yourself. So we clearly still have a problem here. And the administration is pitching this as it's good for business because the rules require if a facility expands or a new facility comes in, they have to meet specific pollution requirements. And without those, then these expanded and new facilities will be able to pollute more in Maine, which, again, it's not a lot of the pollutants produced here, but that's bad for the people of Maine. It also will likely unravel the whole agreement with the other states. And there's some speculation that this is actually the Trump administration pushing Maine to do this so that the ozone transport region will unravel, because obviously the Trump administration is against a lot of regulations on industry. So it was kind of a surprise thing to a lot of folks, public hearing yesterday. If the state moves forward, presents it to the EPA, pretty likely that they will approve it and will be out of the region.
How is this similar to or different than the kind of waivers that the waiver requests that former governors have requested, Governors King, Baldacci, and Baldacci?
Those weren't to take out, I believe, much smaller portions. This would eliminate almost all of Maine, we should say, Acadia and the southern 10 towns, I believe, in York County would stay in. So most of Maine would be out.
All right. Well, we're talking about the month in review with editorial page editors from the Bangor Daily News, Kennebec Journal, and Portland Press Herald. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. What stories matter the most to you? Is it one that we're talking about or something else? Greg, your paper had a big article about child protective services in Maine, and a number of caseworkers came forward to talk about what they're experiencing on the job and said that recent changes within the department have made things worse. This, of course, in the light of two deaths earlier this year of small children. Now the governor's coming forward and saying he's going to come forward, hoping to have legislation by the end of this week. What can we expect from Governor LePage, and is this going to address what these caseworkers are concerned about?
Well, if it's first of all, I would say that that piece was by reporter Eric Russell, and it was just a really outstanding piece of work. He talked to a lot of people on the ground who gave a very chilling description about what it's like to be a child protective caseworker in Maine right now. And the line that I keep is can't get out of my head is somebody said, these reforms they're talking about is like putting a Band-Aid on a bullet hole, that the problems are very deep and they're not going to be solved by just shifting a little bit of money around. The governor has claimed that he's studied this and has come up with a solution. And spoken only about it in very general terms, but it sounds like he is wants to change the focus about when a child is taken into state custody as opposed to reunified with their parents and or families. And he's talking about more training for caseworkers and more I think some more technology, which is something that the caseworkers have brought up. There's been an over-reliance on computer algorithms that kind of identify which cases deserve more attention instead of actual human contact. And he has, oops, I forgot what the other one is. He had another one. anyway, it's the kind of thing where the governor has access to the internal records of the Department of Health and Human Services and has the most information than anybody. But he's not, most of that stuff is confidential, and we don't really know whether his solutions are on point. It doesn't sound like the caseworkers feel that they are. He wanted more higher penalties, legal penalties for people who are mandatory reporters who fail to report. Now, if he could demonstrate that there's a problem, that people who are supposed to report are not reporting, that's probably a good thing to do. But we have no indication that that's what's going on at all. And in fact, in some of the most high-profile cases, we have evidence that there were reports made, and for whatever reason, the child wasn't removed from the situation.
And my understanding is there's been a little bit of back and forth from the administration about whether or not this bill would have new money for new caseworkers. And what we're hearing today, even though DHHS Commissioner Ricker Hamilton had said at one point that there would be more caseworkers hired, now the governor is saying no.
Right. He's going to use it for training and other things. And I think the one of the things the caseworkers have pointed out is they can't fill the positions that they have now. These are very difficult jobs, and it's a toxic environment. And people come in and they don't realize how much work they'll have to do, and how much of it's going to be beyond. It can't be done in 40 hours, and how much work they'll be doing for free. One caseworker described that she was neglecting her own children so that she could keep track of these other children that are under, you know, state custody. So, it's good luck filling jobs with a department that has got such a bad situation right now.
The governor's right to a point that caseworkers do need more training, and you know, the paper system is burdensome and a better system would be helpful. But clearly that we need more caseworkers as well. I don't remember the number of cases assigned to each person, but it's huge. And these are often long, complicated. They're also required to get additional approvals from their supervisors before they make decisions. So the process has gotten more bureaucratic and frustrating. And from Bangor Daily News reporting, we learned that caseworkers have spent, I believe it's about 50 nights in hotels taking care of children who have been taken from their families, but there isn't a placement. There's no foster home available. And so, you know, when the state takes the child, they need to be supervised and go somewhere. So caseworkers are required on a rotating basis to stay with these children, sometimes in a hospital emergency room or in a hotel, which raises questions about the move away from keeping children with their families and taking them from the home, which might be appropriate, but they definitely need a place to go. So just so many problems, as Greg said, you know, a lot of it is hard to access. But when we do start to see internal memos, you just get a sense of a department and a program that's completely overwhelmed, understaffed, and it's very troubling when you're taking care of children who need help, and children and families. I mean, we need to support and help the parents as well, but it's clearly not working as it's intended or as it's supposed to.
Yeah, go ahead, Ben.
We shouldn't forget how this system got so overcrowded. We had the cases jump. The governor didn't cut the system. The system has stayed the same size as the number of cases has skyrocketed. A lot of that has to do with the addiction epidemic.
The opioid epidemic, yeah.
And how we've just not responded to that very well. A lot of it, I think, can be traced back to the kind of systematic weakening of the safety net in the last 7 years. that the governor's had that has really been tough on very poor families that just adds to the host of problems that those families are dealing with. And we know that in those situations with the stress of poverty, these kind of situations come up more that Child Protection Services has to get involved in. So it's not only a matter of fixing the Child Protection Services and fixing that. It's also being aware of all these other problems in Maine communities that are pushing more kids into the system.
We do have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. We're talking about the news in Maine in the month of July. What mattered to you? Give us a call. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Taggart Construction in Freeport, working to create healthy homes that respect the environment since 1994. TagCon.com. And Mercy Hospital, celebrating 100 years in Greater Portland, partnering with the community to deliver the next century of care. MercyHospital.org. And Ocean View at Falmouth, with a new cottage community coming soon in Cumberland. OceanViewRC.com.
Hi, this is Jennifer Ludden. There are so many reasons to listen to NPR News and Maine Public Radio. Maybe it's to make an informed choice when you step in the voting booth, to know your community and be more engaged in it, to have an answer when people ask, "What do you think?" Or maybe it's just to be up on the water cooler conversation. Maine Public Radio brings a lot to your life every day. Now it's time to be part of Maine Public Radio's life, too. It's time to do your part and contribute so this station has the money it takes to be that vital part of your day. Call or go online, and your donation will count towards the Super Thursday one-day membership drive. Thank you.
Super Thursday coming up August 2nd, but you can contribute right now at mainpublic.org or by calling 1-800-866-1475.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking about news from the past month in Maine. Yes, it is July 31st. Joining me today, our panel of editorial page editors. Susan Young joins us from our Bangor studio. She is with the Bangor Daily News here in Portland. Here in Portland, Greg Kessich with the Portland Press Herald and Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We can't talk, Greg, this hour about talking. I don't know what's going on, just a little something in my throat. But when you answer my question, I'll take a drink of water. A lot of pressure right now on Senator Susan Collins.
Yes, my person I work with, Judge Kennedy announced that he was retiring, Sarah Collins said, "Well, there goes Susan Collins' summer." And it's true. I mean, there is a lot of pressure. There is a lot of we're getting deluged with letters. I can only imagine what her office is getting. One of the things that I know that she's getting are personal testimonies from people who have had abortions or have used Planned Parenthood services, telling their own story about how important it is to preserve the national legal safe abortions, and the danger to Roe versus Wade of having another anti-abortion judge on the court. But you know, I think Susan Collins is going to do what she has done consistently throughout her career, which is to look at the qualifications and not decide on an ideological basis. And she voted for both of Barack Obama's Supreme Court justices, and she has voted for a number, even though she is personally pro-choice, she has voted for a number of anti-abortion judges, including Justice Gorsuch, most recently. So I think I would be very surprised if at the end of this process she doesn't, stay true to her history and vote yes.
Susan's Bangor Daily News also getting deluged?
Yes, we are. And a lot of people talking about their experience dealing with Senator Collins' office and you being somewhat dissatisfied. But I don't know if you guys saw today what Jeff Flake, senator from Arizona, is doing. I mean, he's on vacation in Zimbabwe and does not plan to come back in August. And he's on the Senate Judiciary Committee. So there's question whether Kavanaugh's nomination can even make it out of committee if Senator Flake isn't there. So it seems like he's thrown a monkey wrench into the process to slow it all down. So it would be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, you know, I think the pressure obviously is only going to build. Senator Rand Paul, who was kind of considered a maybe a no for one of the Republicans recently, came out and said that he's going to vote yes on the nomination when it comes up. That leaves Senator Collins and Lisa Murkowski from Alaska is kind of the last two, as they were with the health care bill. You know, when this first came out, when Kavanaugh was first nominated, Senator Collins said, you know, absent some sort of evidence that he's not approaching this with an open mind, that he doesn't approach each case with an open mind, then, you know, that's what I'm looking for. That's what I'm looking for in a judge. That's a little disingenuous, I guess, because all these judges have, you know, prior cases and things like that that point in a certain way. And certainly Trump wouldn't nominate someone who he didn't think was going to vote in a certain way, specifically on Roe v. Wade. But now there's some video that's come out of Kavanaugh speaking in support of the dissenting opinion on Roe versus Wade. So, you know, nailing Collins down on that, I think, is going to be interesting to see how she responds to some of these things that make it clear, you know, what everyone kind of knows, and whoever President Trump's nominates is going to be thinking a certain way.
Does this, Greg, does this affect her politically? I mean, obviously, she's not up for re-election this year.
She's not. She's up in 2020, and nobody but she knows what her plans are then. You know, it's hard to believe, but it was just a year ago that when it was the health care votes were going through Congress, and it was that dramatic moment in the Senate where she voted along with John McCain and Lisa Murkowski against the, I forget what it was, the skinny repeal. It was sort of the last gasp at the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, at that time, we were still wondering if she was going to run for governor. And some people were saying she should run for president, you know. And it just shows that, you know, that she's been in the spotlight as a potential swing vote leading up to that moment and since then. And I think, you know, I think the thing we should all remember is how rarely any of these votes have swung. That vote really stands out as pretty much the only time I think the Trump Republican agenda was stopped in Congress. And it's so far, you know, people like Jeff Flake or Bob Corker, who are not running for re-election, have been kind of loose with how critical they are of the president. But basically, anybody who is a Republican who is in office, who plans to face Republican voters, has been pretty loyal to the president. And I don't think we should expect that to change.
We're going to go to Maura, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Maura. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi. My question is, why is it that people are being excluded from government? I mean, the people of Maine approved Medicaid expansion. We said yes. We need that. We need that for our elderly. We need that for our disabled. We need that for our working poor. We approved clean election funds, and they're being held up by one man, LePage. And nothing's happening. I mean, we're going through the motions, but by November, we're not going to have any of our candidates that qualify for these funds being able to actually campaign effectively. Trump uses the same playbook. He's saying he's going to close the federal government if we don't fund a $43 billion wall that, according to him, Mexico was supposed to pay for anyway. And Trump wouldn't nominate Kavanaugh if he wasn't assured of being granted exclusive and absolute executive privileges and being excused for his behaviors.
So Maura, I think that there are a lot of people out there who share your view. Susan.
It's an interesting thing because people voted for referendums that we might consider, you know, kind of to the left, but they also elected LePage as our governor, Trump as president, at least the Electoral College did, not the popular vote. You know, they elected, a lot of folks did, Republicans to represent them in the legislature. And on the funding, clean election funding for the past fiscal year, yes, that is LePage alone. Going forward, it, as Greg said, it's a group of Republicans in the House who refuse to fix the drafting error. So, I mean, it's interesting times when people vote for policies that we consider kind of liberal, but they also, as a whole, elect representatives who are Republican and have contrary views. And we're seeing what happens when those two things butt heads, and you've got a really strong executive who is going to try and uphold his ideological beliefs in any way he can. And even when a court tells him to do something, doesn't really respect that. So, you know, very interesting times that we're living through.
And right. I'm sorry, can I jump in? Yeah. You know, that's, I think that makes the Supreme Court decision very interesting because, you know, we're so used to divided government, both on the state level and in Washington. But really, if you look at most of U.S. history, we did not have divided government. It was one party in control or the other. And we don't have good institutions for ways to resolve differences between ideological parties when they come into conflict. And, you know, Governor LePage has shown he's willing to use every lever at his ability to block things from happening that he doesn't personally approve of, regardless of how they got to his desk. And, you know, are we just going to see that switch to a different party, or are we going to see more divided government? You know, these are big questions, not just in Maine, but nationally. How do you govern a country when you have such polarization where people reject the ideas of the other side and will do anything they can to stop them?
Yeah, the governor has really expanded the use of executive power in a way that we really haven't seen, and he's been willing to carry that out way past when most other people would, and he's been helped by these House Republicans who are doing things that maybe are unpopular for the rest of the state, but are at least, you know, pretty popular in their home district. So they're not really putting anything at risk, and when the executive pushes these powers and does things in a way that is different than the norms that have come up over the years, the bonds, writing the bonds, when that was used to be just a signature from the governor, he's turned that into leverage. He's taken all these things and turned them into leverage and pushed the bounds of the law. And when that happens, it goes to the courts, which works really slow. And that's what we're seeing: clean elections, Medicaid expansion, all these things. It takes a long time. You know, the legislature can just pass a bill. And when the legislature can't do that and you have to go to the courts, it takes a long time. And that's obviously really frustrating for the people who voted for those things. But, you know, do we turn back from that now? Does the next governor use the same tactics? You know, that's a big question.
Maura, thank you so much for your call. And if you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We have an email from Janet. This is about clean elections. Couldn't this be a violation of election laws? They are preventing a, quote, free and fair election by handicapping candidates using what seems to be an after-the-fact decision. Could the legislature be sued for not addressing this issue with a vote that would fix the wording of the law and thus release the money to the candidates who signed on to public financing? This certainly seems to have ended up as a partisan issue, with the Republicans withholding campaign money for mostly Democratic candidates. Could supporters of a candidate on their own place campaign ads? A couple of questions there, several, but the first one is the interesting one. Could this be a violation of election laws?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, could this end up in court? Why not? Everything else is.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, the point is, a point that needs to be made is that it wasn't all Republicans who voted against fixing the typo in the budget. It was a small group of House Republicans who had enough votes to deny 2/3 support to a veto override. So and they refused to pass the routine bill that every legislature passes because they
because there are always typos.
There's typos. You know, that's the world, right? People make a mistake now and then, and so they had a routine bill that would fix errors, and they killed it.
Well, we have what's holding up this ongoing, interminable legislative session is that, the four caucuses, the House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans, are negotiating over this clean elections typo and the tax conformity, the federal tax conformity. And they're doing this all and have been for the last month or so in secret. And then they come out and they say then they fight over what was said behind closed doors. And it's really hard for us in the press and obviously for people, too, to figure out what's on the table and who's at fault here, because we're not in those discussions. It's just like with the budget, when they go behind, we don't know what the trade-offs are, and it's really hard to judge what the final, what's going on here. It's pretty frustrating, especially when they should have handled this, months ago.
And Susan, do we know the answer to Janet's last question was, could supporters of a candidate on their own place campaign ads?
That's a good question. I mean, it's like third-party spending.
Yeah, independent.
The dark money groups that we don't like. So probably.
You can start your own dark money group.
Yeah, but I just wanted to point out, Maura's question brings up a good point. Our laws are written to be followed. So Ben mentioned bonds. There's not something in the law that says if the governor refuses to sign this, he gets fined or he goes to jail or he goes to time out. Our administrative laws aren't written with penalties. So when he just refuses to do it, the only recourse is for an aggrieved individual to go to court and sue him. But could you imagine if we went back through all our statutes and put in penalties for if the governor or legislature or whoever is supposed to fulfill what the law says refuses to do it? But we haven't seen a situation where a governor so frequently just refuses to do what the law says. And that's the hard thing, that there's not a mechanism to force him to comply.
We have to take one more break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Theater at Monmouth, presenting the psychological thriller Dial M for Murder, now through August 17th. Tickets at theateratmonmouth.org. And Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communications systems. NorrisInc.com. And Toad & Co., sustainable apparel and curated goods for the adventure that is life. Committed to living well and doing good in downtown Freeport, Maine.
There are the usual messages about why you should be involved in supporting this station this week on Super Thursday. We keep the campaign short to just one day. New members are so important, as is support from those of you visiting the great state of Maine this summer, and the fact that you rely on and trust this service. So here's the big question. If you're not already supporting or planning to support, what would your listening be like? How would you keep up to date if public radio were not available or weren't the same service that listener support now makes possible? Please do think about it, and please do your part this Super Thursday, or right now if you'd like, online at mainpublic.org, and thank you.
Super Thursday coming up this Thursday, but you can contribute right now at mainpublic.org. And coming up shortly at 2 o'clock, right after Maine Calling, it's Intelligence Squared, a debate on the following question. Is social media good for democracy? Here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, The Month in News. My guests are Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, and Greg Kesich with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Join our conversation 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Going to Maggie, who's calling from York Beach. Hi, Maggie. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I just wanted to make a comment when you were speaking earlier about Susan Collins. I'm a registered Democrat, but I have voted for her because I think she does very well for the state of Maine. But I do have a problem with the Supreme Court nomination, particularly with the rhetoric, which I was surprised that all your panel used, anti-abortion. And I understand this is a hot topic and people see it as a religious issue, but as a woman, I see it as anti-choice versus pro-choice. In other words, a civil rights issue. And that's how I see it.
Yeah, Maggie, I understand. Yeah, I understand where you're coming from. I know that within newsrooms for decades, there's been a real, difficult discussions about terminology around this issue. And I believe, Greg, it's AP Style book now, isn't it, that it's pro-choice and anti-abortion. That's considered the neutral in this very heated discussion.
I guess so. Yeah, I think in the past, the preferred line was abortion rights advocate and anti-abortion. And I think, the caller's point is correct. It really, it's not like people want everybody to have an abortion. It's the question of who gets to decide when a pregnancy is going to be terminated. Pro-life is a preferred term by the what I consider to be the anti-abortion side, and I consider that sort of a euphemism. It's implying that other people are not pro-life. So. This is a really difficult issue, and it is it's a complicated issue that people decide on a personal basis. But the caller's point is well taken that is really what you're talking about is choice.
Right.
And who gets to make the choice.
And language matters. Yeah. Susan, discussion you've had throughout your journalism career?
Not a lot of focus on it, but on a lot of other topics as well. I mean, especially with the opioid crisis, calling it substance abuse disorder versus, an addiction, and certainly language about sexual assault and intimate partner violence and the use of the word victim versus survivor. So a lot of these really difficult emotional issues. It's a big topic of discussion and, trying to be accurate and sensitive at the same time.
Yeah. And I think even substance abuse disorder, now we use substance use disorder.
Right.
Yeah. That's really where this has come up most for me. And we're a lot of times we're just trying to say something with the least amount of words. And, calling the groups addicts, I've certainly done that in the past and then been called out for it. And, while writing editorials that were for more treatment and for better treatment of people with substance use disorder. Especially with something like the addiction crisis, a big part of it is the stigma around it. And one of the ways that we can help change that is by changing the language and the way people talk about it. And sometimes, if someone's calling me out on it, I have this, this feeling of I'm on your side here, just lay off. But, it's true that the language matters and that over time we can change how people think about this by changing the way they talk about it.
And I will say the other side is that sometimes groups will want you to use something that's so euphemistic
right. That
readers won't even know what you mean.
Right,
so
yeah,
you have to
yeah.
sort of make the decision, yeah. what is the correct term versus what will actually be clear, precise
right,
language.
Right. I mean, we can't always use 10 words, when we have one word that will work. But even if the 10 words is slightly more accurate, right?
I would say that, with the change in the terminology around sex trafficking, what we used to call prostitution is now most commonly referred to as sex trafficking, and it changes the focus of who is breaking the law and who's the victim in a way that I think has a, real meaning. It's not just a euphemism. It's a kind of a change of an idea.
An email from Kristen. I hear that Governor LePage wants to improve the Department of Health and Human Services, specifically child welfare. I also read in today's Bangor Daily News that LePage is being sued by Senator Brownie Carson and two public health nurses for not releasing money already allocated to hire 24 public health nurses who visit new mothers with newborns who are at risk. LePage has nearly gutted the state public health program. I also hear that LePage is proud to have $316 million in cash reserves for the state of Maine. This is a no-brainer. Hire the nurses and the others who are needed to protect the children. Susan, is this what you're hearing from? You're hearing this from one of your readers.
Yeah, sounds like a letter to the editor.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Can you just forward that to me?
I'll be happy to. Elaine on Facebook writes, regarding Medicare expansion, the party that likes to say it's your fiscal responsibility never talks about the cost of having millions of uninsured, if the cost of not dealing with climate change, a one-dimensional view of fiscal responsibility.
Yeah, that's true. You know, we pay a lot of attention to direct costs, but don't pay attention much to the indirect costs that come up all the time. And it's a real struggle with all legislatures and elected officials and even people in the media. It's, you know, when you put a price tag on something in a bill, it's very easy to tell how much it costs, but it's very difficult to figure out all the ways that not having, you know, for instance, expanding Maine Care, all the ways that hurts us, you know, not to mention the very real federal money that we're giving up, but all the other ways that all the costs that we accrue just by not insuring people.
We'll go to Olivia, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Olivia, go ahead.
Hi. Well, I'm trying to protect the Falmouth from Maine. They're doing like holes like in the wall. I'm trying to protect it, and I don't know why they're doing this.
So Olivia has a question why the policies that have been enacted by Trump and environmental protection agencies are actually hurting the environment, or agencies that are supposed to be protecting the environment, and they're actually hurting, especially for Maine, if they're planning on drilling for oil off the coast of Maine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the EPA is there to protect the environment, and that's something that the Trump administration just doesn't really believe in. It's not a surprise, though. He ran on this. He ran on lower regulations. He ran on coal, you know, reinvigorating the coal industry and cutting back on clean energy. And his victory in 2016 is going to be very consequential for those things, because those are a lot of things that he can do outside of Congress, and he can just make executive orders to change these things. And we're really going to suffer in Maine because there's not a lot of ways for us to move the needle ourselves with clean energy. We've done a pretty good job of doing things that are good for the environment here in the state, but they don't really move the needle nationwide. Yet we feel all the bad effects when regulations are cut.
We don't have the power California does.
Exactly.
Susan, though, it sounds like Olivia is particularly concerned about the potential for offshore drilling off the coast of Maine. Most experts don't really believe that that's likely, correct?
Right. I mean, there's not many resources off the coast of Maine. It's very expensive to drill offshore. So, you know, don't want to say it's not going to happen, but I think that's very unlikely. But as Ben mentioned, a lot of other things that we do need to be concerned about: clean energy policy, climate change, and the Trump administration. A lot of agencies are headed by former business executives, and not surprising, those folks are going to protect the interests of their former colleagues. And, you know, the president has been very clear that he's pro-business, anti-regulation. So unfortunately, whether it's the environment, consumer protections, you know, health and food safety and things, you know, we're going to see rollbacks, and people are going to suffer for that, which is very unfortunate. But it was what we expected with a Trump administration. It's the question is, what do we do about it and where can we be effective? And that can be, you know, hard to do when the powers are aligned against you.
You know, it's sort of the what's the role of the permanent government? You know, we have mayors come and go in cities, but police chiefs remain and cops continue to enforce the law. You don't get this complete shake up every time somebody wins an election. But what we're seeing in the state level and in Washington is this sort of introduction of a, you know, politically polarized administration of everything. Immigration becomes an issue of politics. So does clean water, you know, clean air, taxation, all these things that had a certain momentum from administration to administration where they're consistently enforced are now up for grabs.
Yeah, and I think you could probably add to that things like the State Department, diplomacy.
Right.
Ben,
NATO.
Do you expect that, you know, history is cyclical, and if Democrats, you know, come into office, that they're going to use the same playbook because now that playbook's been established?
That's always the danger. I don't know. If you'd asked me 2 years ago if we were going to be where we are now, right, I wouldn't have known that. So looking out 2 years is tough. It does seem to be a cycle of someone, you know, group in power and then a backlash to that. President Trump is just such his own entity that it's something we have never seen before in American politics, coming at a time when our country is split like it's never been before because of the way media is split and the way people consume media and the way people look at politics. Are we going to bounce back like that, or are people just going to keep pushing outward and away from each other? And I think that's the real danger. It's going to really depend on leadership. You see what the leadership of President Trump has done to push people further away. It's going to take special people who really would apply themselves to bringing them back together to do that. And then even then, I don't know if the forces are too big. I don't mean to be so cynical about it, right?
Well, you know, we're kind of out of time. It's such an interesting conversation, and I apologize to those of you whose questions we did not get to. But important conversation about where our state and our nation is headed. Thank you all for being here today. That voice you just heard, Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. And Greg Kesich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Sandra Harris ran the board today. We had help in Bangor from George Thomas. Thank you, George. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, links and resources, all sorts of things, at mainecalling.org. Today's program will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Please join us tomorrow when we talk about what's new in the world of yoga. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.